Welcome to episode 41 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other, joining us from Ireland. We ought to have a new feature called Where in the World is Stuart Baker, and this week he's in Ireland. Mike Vadis, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Our guest commentator today is John Lynch, the chief of the Computer Crime and IP Section in the Criminal Division at DOJ. And I'm Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where I had the privilege of supervising John's section for 4 years, among other things, and I'm now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Let's get started, as we do so often, with this week in the NSA. Stuart?
Sure. A couple of things. The second leaker, that is the central plot point of Laura Poitras's film about Edward Snowden. Boy, talk about stepping on your Oscar speech. The FBI has already busted him. This is the guy Poitras makes a big deal out of having, and so does Greenwald, saying, this is the second leaker. He's inspired by you, Mr. Snowden. He provided us with figures and details about how the terrorist watch list is put together. I think we've talked about this. The secrets weren't all that impressive as secrets. They were variants on things that were already publicly known. And this was the second leaker only if you live in a Greenwald-centered universe. It was the second leaker that had come to them. Talk about a bust. He has been busted. There is some question about the enthusiasm of the National Security Division for yet another espionage trial, but my guess is they'll find a way to penalize this guy, assuming he really is the leaker. The other story is a kind of an odd one. It's British focused, but trying to create an issue here as well. The claim that GCHQ, which is the UK version of NSA, can access data provided by NSA without a warrant. Now, all of that information has already been gathered lawfully by the National Security Agency and can be searched by NSA under a variety of privacy restrictions that don't include getting a warrant for searches. And I think the idea that they can't share it without a warrant is certainly a novel legal theory. But I also want to flag the fact that this may not even be completely true. It's a statement by Privacy International claiming that it extracted this concession from GCHQ in the course of a hearing that was not public. And so you can be reasonably sure that they put their preferred spin on this. And so until we get further facts, I'm not even entirely sure that Privacy International's version of the story, which is the only one we have so far, is the one you can take to the bank. And then the last NSA story is also an FBI story, so I thought Mike should handle it.
Sure. This is the speech by former FBI Director Bob Mueller, who, like a lot of other current and former administration officials, has said the Snowden leaks were devastating to national security efforts to investigate and disrupt various threats to national security. I find these statements extremely difficult to evaluate because there's really very little concrete that we can look at to judge or assess these sort of statements. The things that I think have been clearly the result of the Snowden leaks, and those are making life more difficult for intelligence agencies, are the efforts now by communications companies and hardware and software manufacturers to make encryption a regular part of their operations. That's certainly going to make life more difficult for intelligence as well as for law enforcement. I think we've also definitely seen an impact on cloud computing companies that are based in the U.S. since they're losing a lot of business abroad as a result of people's distrust of the U.S. government. But as to, you know, whether terrorists are not using certain means of communications that they used to before the Snowden leaks, count me a skeptic on that front. But I think whether you believe it or not, there's just very little information to assess those things by.
So let me, Mike, let me give you one example, and you tell me why you would be skeptical about it. The New York Times and Snowden disclosed that the U.S. National Security Agency had been spying on ISIS by because ISIS was using this methodology of simply modifying draft Gmail messages rather than sending them, and they would just go in and make serial modifications. It's sort of hard to believe that ISIS wouldn't have stopped doing that and that we wouldn't have lost access to those communications.
Well, first of all, I'm shocked that you would cite the New York Times as a credible source of information to support a position. But second of all, I would have thought, you know, if ISIS is actually reading the news, they would have stopped using that method after David Petraeus was busted using that method to communicate with a woman other than his wife.
Oh, but they have a Google search for ISIS. They didn't have a Google search for Petraeus.
Well, I don't know how that just feeds my skepticism. How they can link that to the Snowden leaks is just seems like a bit of a
That was a Snowden leak. That was a Snowden leak and a story in the New York Times that said, "Hey, look at what they're doing to ISIS." So there's no doubt it was a Snowden leak, and it came through the New York Times. I'm not citing them for the truth of the matter, just for the fact that they did engage in those kinds of activities.
I still think this. I can cross off my bucket list hearing Stuart quote the New York Times. Now I just need Stuart to quote MSNBC, and I'll be all done. Stuart, I don't know if you wanted to just tease, we'll talk to John a little bit about it later in the show, but if you wanted to tease our upcoming discussion about the ITU and its ongoing efforts to take control of the internet.
Yeah, the ITU has had a couple of big meetings. They just finished a meeting in South Korea, and the meetings have featured debates about the extent to which the ITU ought to exercise jurisdiction over the internet, whether it should be treated essentially as a bunch of phone lines, or whether it should be treated as an information service, and the debate has principally been between countries like China and Russia, which say we really would like to have our own internet and the rest of you can buzz off, and the U.S., which is arguing that there should only be a single unitary internet without national divisions. The U.S. has been, ever since the Snowden issues broke, the U.S. has been on its back foot in meeting after meeting, and continues to be, I think, one of the results of the meeting in South Korea was the Secretary General is now a Chinese government official. And so while there hasn't been a final resolution of the question of what the ITU's role, if any, will be in regulating the internet, there's a gradual creeping intrusion of ITU authority into internet affairs, and I think we're going to continue to see that, but it'll be discussed in considerable detail in our next session with Danny Sepulveda, who is the U.S. ambassador to the ITU and who has been present for all of these meetings, including the walkout in the Persian Gulf, and we'll get his take on how likely it is that the U.S. will be able to keep the internet free of ITU regulation for the foreseeable future.
So bringing things closer to the domestic front, the state of New York Department of Financial Services issued a letter this week to dozens of banks that it regulates that really put the focus on vendor management, in particular cybersecurity at law firms and accounting firms. You know, as listeners of the podcast know, we've been saying since the very beginning of the podcast that vendor management is a critical part of cybersecurity, that it's not enough to worry about your own network security these days. You have to worry about the security of the third parties with whom you do business and have access to your data, your systems, because as Target is a fairly notable example of, a third-party system can be a launching pad for an attack on yours. And now the focus on vendor management among regulators is growing. The New York Department of Financial Services Superintendent Ben Losky, who was in AUSA with me back in the day in New York, sent a letter on October 21st to several dozen banks asking specifically for information about the extent to which they have focused on and dealt with security risks among their third-party vendors. The letter from Mr. Losky made an observation that a firm's level of cybersecurity is only as good as the cybersecurity practices of its vendors, and he indicated it's important for financial institutions to be able to identify and monitor and mitigate any cyber risks posed by their vendors, including specifically law firms and accounting firms. And he said in the letter that New York DFS is actually considering a rule that would require financial institutions to get representations and warranties from their third-party service providers regarding the cybersecurity practices in place at those providers, and ask the financial institutions to provide, I think by tomorrow, information about their current practices for dealing with third-party vendors' cybersecurity risk. And among the information they're asking for are the due diligence processes that the banks have for evaluating their vendors' data security, the extent to which those institutions have adopted protections for sensitive data sent to and from their vendors, such as encryption or multi-factor authentication, any protections against loss that the banks have in place, including insurance coverage, and any measures that they've taken to implement the NIST framework as it relates to third parties. And the question about the NIST framework is interesting in itself because it illustrates something that we've talked about on the show before, that the framework is gaining traction beyond critical infrastructure and is likely to be one way that cyber programs in many different sectors of the economy will be measured. And as I think all of us have said from time to time, this could end up becoming the de facto standard of care. And, you know, for those of us in law firms know that for the past year or two, banks have already been focused on cybersecurity measures in place at their outside counsel. Cyber questions are increasingly a significant part of proposals that that law firms submit. Banks and other companies are increasingly requiring an audit of their law firm systems, and law firms are increasingly being required to demonstrate that they have programs in place to manage their own vendors. So now that this issue has become the focus of regulators, especially one as prominent as New York DFS, I think law firms and accounting firms and all types of vendors who do business with banks can expect these kinds of questions and these kinds of audits with greater frequency. So one of the stories I thought was most interesting this week involved action against hackers that wasn't by law enforcement or the intelligence community, but was by a coalition of private companies. I think, Mike, you were following that story.
Yeah, there's a security company called Novetta released a report, and obviously a bunch of press releases touting its campaign to disrupt hacking efforts by an apparently Chinese-affiliated group that it dubbed Axiom, which had infiltrated the computers of 43,000 companies, government agencies, NGOs, and others. And as part of this campaign, which involved dozens of companies, they distributed malware detection tools and malware removal tools, which helped shut down the operations of this company, of this this Axiom group. So I think, you know, if you give credence to the reports and the press releases, it seems like a pretty significant instance of private sector information sharing. I'd be interested to hear from John whether the government was in fact involved at all and participated in sharing information and the like.
Yeah, from our perspective, and certainly CSIPs wasn't. This seems to be a private sector initiative. I can talk a little bit more about this overall initiative and kind of what we think about it a little bit later.
One of the other interesting stories this week involved the FCC, which has now entered the competition to become our country's de facto data protection authority. I'm personally happy to see this because I frequently, in talking about the FTC, call them the FCC, and now I don't have to worry about which agency I'm talking about, because now they both want a piece of the pie when it comes to data security. First, the FCC, announced its intent to fine two phone carriers a total of $10 million for lapses in data security practices that allegedly exposed personal information of over 300,000 consumers, including allegedly misrepresenting their data security practices and failing to notify the consumers of the exposure of the data in a timely manner. And that was on the heels of big privacy-related settlements the FCC reached with Verizon and Sprint over marketing practices and do-not-call issues, respectively. And now the FCC has announced that it's joined the Global Privacy Enforcement Network, which is an international group of privacy enforcers from 50 countries around the world, whose objective is to promote cross-border cooperation among enforcement agencies on privacy issues. And the 50 members include DPAs from Austria, the EU, France, Germany, and a number of other countries. Up to now, the U.S. has been primarily represented by the FTC, and now the FCC will be joining them. And I think we can look for the FCC to be even more active in this space, not just enforcing do-not-call rules, but now looking at the data security practices and representations of the companies within its jurisdiction. So for those of you who are getting tired of talking about the FTC, see, I do it all the time. Now we have another agency to talk about. And our next to last story before we get to the interview with John involves a FireEye report regarding a new cyber weapon in Russia. Mike, were you following that story?
Yeah, you know, if it seems like government agencies are vying for primacy in the cybersecurity area, that's certainly the case among private cybersecurity companies because, you know, you've had this Novetta report about China. Now we've got a FireEye report about Russia and its hacking efforts. And, you know, Russia has a leader in cyber intelligence gathering focused on U.S. government agencies and defense contractors and high-tech companies. And I think the most notable thing is that its activities are generally a lot quieter, a lot more careful, a lot more focused than China's, to the point where the DNI, General Clapper, actually remarked that he's a lot more scared of Russia in this field than of China, which I thought was an interesting statement. And it's, you know, it's, I guess a competition in this area is a good thing since we'll learn a lot more about what our adversaries are doing as companies vie to get out there and release as much information as they can get.
So finally, Stuart's going to talk to you about another candidate we have for the dumbest privacy case of the year. This is fresh on the heels of our report a few weeks ago about a privacy case involving upskirt photographs. Now we're going to tell you about photographs from another perspective of the human body. This is privacy and cleavage. Stuart, what can you tell us about that?
What could be better? We should have started the show with that. Everybody knows the Street View car comes down your street and takes pictures so that it can put up the Street View map of your street. And in 2009, a woman named Maria Grillo was sitting out on her step when the Google car came through, and she was wearing, a moderately skimpy top and leaning over to check her messages. She was caught, I guess it's fair to call it cleavage or maybe a little more, nothing particularly shocking. But she was apparently, or at least said she was, very embarrassed by it, that she was teased at work about it. They had, in the standard fashion, fuzzed out her face, but not the rest of her, including not her address, not surprisingly, since they want to show the address, or the license plate of her car. So she said, I'm perfectly obviously identifiable here, and it caused me great embarrassment. The judge Google said, excuse me, you were in public, we were on a street, we took pictures that anybody could have taken, you don't really have a privacy interest in what you look like when you're sitting out on the stoop. The judge said, oh, that's so American, we're much more European up here in Quebec. That'll be $2,250 for privacy invasion. A little unclear about what it was, except that it was an unconsented picture. It's kind of a throwback to Justice Brandeis, although imagining him providing cleavage to the world is something I don't really want to get into. I'm going to nominate this for our first Dubious Achievement in Privacy Law Award for 2015. We're going to have three or four candidates for Dubious Achievement in Privacy Law in a host of categories. One of them will be Dumbest Privacy Law Decision of the Year, and I think this is in the running for that. So watch for future nominations between now and the end of the year for the prizes that we lovingly call the privies.
Hey, so, Stuart, can listeners make nominations, or is this just up to fiat of you or this group?
No, we are absolutely delighted to get nominations. At the end of the show, Jason will go through the feedback mechanisms that you can use. But we would be pleased to get nominations. We do reserve the right not to accept the nominations if we don't think they actually fit the intent of the prize. But if your nomination is not accepted or you don't put one forward, at the end of the year we'll tell everybody how to vote. And while we count the votes of privacy professionals more heavily than the votes of just the ordinary public, if you've listened to more than five of these podcasts, you probably count as a privacy professional.
Well, upskirts one week and cleavage the next week. It's probably only a matter of time before we get a subpoena from the FCC. So now let's turn to the interview segment of the program. John Lynch, as I mentioned, is the chief of the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section, which is commonly referred to in the law enforcement community as CSIPs. Very proud to have been John's colleague for 4 years and even prouder to be his friend. He's a consummate public servant, and I really appreciate him taking time out of a very busy schedule to be here with us. So John, welcome.
Thanks.
And why don't we start out, since everybody in law enforcement knows what CSIPs is, but many of our listeners probably don't. If you could describe for us what CSIPs is and generally how the department is organized for investigations and prosecutions of computer crime.
Okay. CSIPs was created about 18 years ago when we had a cybercrime unit, needed a section that was going to be focused on issues relating to computer hacking cases, theft of intellectual property, and electronic evidence issues primarily. Since then, we've developed a cybercrime laboratory. That laboratory has as its main focus supporting prosecutors in being able to understand and explain technology to judges and juries and others. The section has a very varied role. We have people who are participating directly in litigation in partnership with the U.S. Attorney's offices. So we can bring a national perspective, often an international perspective, to the cases. So if you have a data breach that happens in, say, Iowa, we can come in and assist the U.S. Attorney's Office. They're going to have the local expertise. They're going to have the relationship with the victim. CSIPs can also bring the knowledge of the tools and the investigative steps necessary so that they can work successfully with the victim and with law enforcement. We also provide assistance in a wide variety of cases, not just cybercrime and intellectual property, just relating to electronic evidence. More and more, as you've talked about on the show, we're dealing with electronic evidence and providers, and that's where the information is for investigative purposes. And we also have an intellectual property group that focuses on IP outreach, international work, training, and policy.
And how do you, with the limited resources that you have, what are the highest priority areas for investigating and prosecuting cybercrime? Everyone who listens to the show knows, and people who are readers of the New York Times and virtually every other form of media in the world know that there's just a tremendous number of breaches of a great profile that affect a large number of consumers. You can't prosecute or investigate all of them. So how do you decide sort of how to deploy your resources?
Yeah, well, we've always had limited resources. We have about 40 attorneys in the section at our maximum, and we've been down from there because of budget cuts and sequestration and so forth. So one of the most important tenets that I got from my predecessors was the importance of partnership and cooperation to get the most done with that, the resources we have. And one of the ways we've done that is to leverage the computer hacking and intellectual property coordinators, or CHIPS, in the U.S. attorney's offices. We train them once a year at least, in a big conference down in South Carolina. And then we provide them with assistance throughout the year. And again, that partnership model is the way that we try to leverage our resources as much as possible with respect to investigation and prosecution of criminal cases. And then over the last few years, the National Security Division has moved and begun to really focus on cyber as a major part of its mission. It had always been part of it, but with Lisa Monaco and then John Carlin, they really have focused on it. And about 3 years ago, or a couple years ago now, National Security Division created what they call the National Security Cyber Specialist Network, which is similar to the CHIP network. It includes CSIPs as part of it. And that helps us in cases where we don't know whether an intrusion may be the work of a nation state actor or an organized criminal group. So in many cases, the techniques and sophistication are very similar. And at the beginning, we don't want to make too many decisions at the start. So we've been very working very closely with them. And in fact, one of my former deputy chiefs is now at National Security Division. Luke Domboski is now a deputy assistant attorney general, working on cyber matters. And as far as what kinds of cases, you know, where we try to spend our resources, we're always going to try to gravitate where we can do our best work, which in this case is the particularly complex cases that span districts or even span countries. We absolutely need and rely upon the U.S. Attorney's offices in dealing with this, and so partnership, again, just makes sense. But CSIPs can come in and focus on the aspects of the cases where we can bring a national perspective, where we can bring the experience from a decade of data breach cases to maybe a district that hasn't had that, but suddenly has a victim, a major victim in their district, and we can assist them. We can also focus on helping with the international aspects of investigations. We work closely with the Office of International Affairs and can provide that assistance to investigators and prosecutors, because more and more we need to use mutual legal assistance treaties to get evidence, and we need to rely on international law enforcement cooperation in order to get where we are, where we need to go in furthering our investigations.
So I think a lot of people would be surprised. I know when I first started working with the section in 2009, I was surprised how much human and financial resources are devoted to building capacity in other countries to investigate and prosecute cybercrime. Talk about that and why that's so important to the work of the section.
Yeah, from our perspective, it's pretty much everything we do is in some way building capacity. Even if we're working on a case with a country, we're trying to build the partnerships. We're trying to build the technical capacity. They're teaching us in some cases what will help what will work in a case, or particular aspects of the challenges that they face. So every interaction we have with a foreign country in some sense is building capacity here or there. But as far as our training and policy development, that's a significant, probably it's 25% of our work overall. We do a significant amount of training. We try to do it as efficiently as possible. We try to leverage international organizations, the Organization of American States, the Council of Europe, and other organizations that can help us reach the broadest audience possible. And our goal in all of these is building legal frameworks so that people can investigate and prosecute computer crime and intellectual property crime and other types of crime that occur over networks efficiently, and we're trying to build technical capacity where that's necessary. So the FBI and Secret Service and other agencies are working on they work more closely with the agents, but there's also needs to be understanding at the prosecutorial level and at the judicial level about why these cases are important, why these cases matter, and how they may differ in some ways from the traditional crimes that they may have seen in the past. And then finally, we need to make sure that we're continuing to build national will or political will to bring those cases. Not every country sees cybercrime or intellectual property crime as their highest priority, and in some cases it won't be. But what we're trying to do is make sure that they're seeing this as a sort of a global fight in this area, that countries that are not that do not have intellectual property protections in place, that don't have protections against or don't have laws against cybercrime, they're going to be less likely to attract investment and people who are going to put their intellectual property into that country, and if they can't be assured that it's going to be protected if it's stolen. But we need to reach, our goal has been to reach as many countries as possible, because we don't know where these cases are going to start or end up, or route through. And in some cases, we've had criminals routing their traffic through, different countries, and we've had to seek cooperation from those countries just to trace back, the source of an attack. And so it's important for us to have at least a baseline level of this, again, legal authorities, technical capacity, and political will to work on this in this area.
Yeah, I think people don't realize that it's not just a matter of cooperation between the U.S. and the country where the hackers ultimately are. It's all the other countries in between that the communications might have been routed through, so you can even find out where the hackers are and ultimately
That's
focus
correct.
Your efforts there.
Yeah.
So one of the things we talk about on this program a lot is the phenomenon that one of the greatest and longest lasting impacts of Snowden and his leaks is actually not necessarily felt by the intelligence community, but by domestic law enforcement. And you were just mentioning MLATs and international cooperation. One of the things that seems to have gotten traction or greater traction since the Snowden leaks has been a chorus of voices calling for reform of the MLAT process, and there seems to be momentum for data localization laws in a lot of countries. How in the post-Snowden world, how has the level of cooperation with the United States, with U.S. law enforcement changed, if at all, and what do you think is the outlook for MLAT reform?
On the level of cooperation with our international partners, that continues to be robust. It has to be. We are working closely with our partners in Europe, and and the Snowden revelations have certainly caused a great deal of discussion in the policy spheres, but when law enforcement talks to one another and we're trying to identify major frauds or people who are being injured or other victims of crime, the common instinct of prosecutors and investigators to find the bad guy is there, and it is a big motivating force. That doesn't mean that it hasn't made things more complex. We certainly have partners who have expressed concerns based upon the Snowden leaks, and it is, as you suggested, sometimes I feel like we're the picture of Dorian Gray, and the leaks in general didn't really deal with law enforcement, and yet law enforcement is the most public is the most public place where people can kind of take a stand, and so we have had in general law enforcement is dealing with investigative requests that are targeted, that are overseen by judicial authorities, and which when we try to introduce it into court at a later time, it's, you know, the reasonableness of the actions by law enforcement are tested in an adversarial process in front of a judge, and what we look at in all of the what we look at in all of those cases, and what we did is going to be looked at carefully. But you know, Congress and courts and providers, rightly so, have a great interest in making sure that they're protecting the privacy of their customers, and they're making sure that the process is as rigorous and transparent as possible. And that is a challenge for law enforcement. That's not a new challenge for law enforcement. This is something that we've done for...
John, let me follow up on something that Jason said, because I think you're sugarcoating this a little. It seems to me that to a significant degree, Snowden is the excuse, but the motivation for a lot of this data localization is to get it down in Brazil where the Brazilian cops can get it without having to go through MLAT processes in the United States, or to get it into Germany where they can get it without all the, well, I'm sure they consider the folderol of the MLAT and U.S. procedures. And that raises question about, you know, what we're doing to try to fix the MLAT process so that there's less friction in those gears.
Right. Well, believe me, I'm a big, although I think the concept of MLAT reform is kind of a loaded term in and of itself. We do need to improve the means by which we're sharing data and cooperating with one another. It needs to be faster because we can't wait days, we can't wait weeks or months to help with an investigation. In many cases, we've had to work in a matter of hours or days to get things done. You're right. Data localization, is kind of a reaction to the slowness of the system. You know, when MLATs were first, designed in the 1970s, it was an improvement upon the letters rogatory process, which was on the order of years. You know, MLATs brought it down to months. And, you know, right now we need something that will probably be, again, on the order of days or hours. A lot of progress, I think, significant progress was made on that with the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime. It at least provided a mechanism for freezing or preserving data, and had in it, some procedures that allowed, more rapid cooperation on certain legal methods of getting data. But in the end, we probably need to continue to move forward on this. Some of it will be technological amelioration and making sure that we can cooperate quicker. At the end, there is, and as the president has recognized this, there is basic resource needs. The number of mutual legal assistance requests relating to electronic evidence has gone, you know, up by multiples in the last 10 years. The resources have pretty much stayed the same. And while we can spend money, and we should spend money to try to make the process as efficient as possible as far as moving the paper through. At the end, there is, the MLAT system relies on judgments of U.S. prosecutors, of U.S. judges to make sure that, evidence, is appropriately shared in appropriate cases and that we preserve, the privacy of our citizens and make sure that it's done according to rule of law. And while we can work to get to that decision point as quickly as possible, there's no substitute for the, there's no short circuiting of the underlying application of judgment and legal standards in that area. back to data localization, that is a concern for us. I mean, that just from a strictly law enforcement perspective, it makes it hard for us to know exactly where the data is to begin with. If you have sort of a fracturing of providers keeping data in different places, we may need three requests just to find out where the data resides to begin with. So that's a big concern for me on just from a strictly law enforcement perspective, and of course, the USG generally has been talking about the difficulties of data localization.
You should adopt a rule that says that data can't be exported unless it's to a regime that has adequate protection of the rights of the parties whose data is being examined. I don't think any data could be exported under that theory.
Well, that's certainly some have suggested that. There are good questions about how practical that is in the current environment. Certainly the position of the U.S. is that restrictions on the flow of data in that way is we're for the free flow of information, and so putting that kind of restriction on data flows, I think, would be contrary to the position that we've been taking for the last 20 years in the sort of development of the internet.
You know, the reality is that, as you said, you know, there are process improvements that can be made, technological improvements, there's resource issues to be addressed. But fundamentally, a lot of the countries that complain about the MLAT process, the real complaint is that it derives from the fact that they can't meet our legal standards to get the data. In their own countries, they would need little or no judicial review, certainly nothing approaching the legal standards that a U.S. prosecutor has to meet. And when you apply U.S. standards to those requests, sometimes they just can't meet them. And that's reflects the fact that our privacy protections are as robust as they are. You know, and as you know, the department was struggling to make that argument for years before anyone knew who Snowden was, that even issuing a paper called the Five Myths paper that tried to make the point that, contrary to popular belief, U.S. privacy protections when it comes to government access to data, law enforcement access to data, are as strong or stronger than anywhere in the world. It's just that since Snowden, the government's like the grown-ups talking in peanuts. No one wants to hear that, and it become infinitely harder to make that case. You mentioned the Budapest Convention, John, earlier in the show. We mentioned the ITU, the movement to give the ITU a greater role in internet governance. Could you explain, just generally speaking, is that movement to give the ITU greater authority a threat to the Budapest Convention? You know, why should law enforcement care? Why should providers care? Why should the ordinary internet user care? Who, you know, I'm using air quotes here, governs the internet?
Well, I mean, obviously the ITU's role is that issue is a serious one, and you're going to be able to talk about it next week with Ambassador Sepulveda, and they're doing, you know, a lot of very good work there. The U.S. delegation is, and the ITU has a role to play in the government, and we've recognized that it has a role to play in the overall setting of standards, and exactly what that role is still under consideration. The Budapest Convention and cybercrime is something that the ITU has not claimed or been in, or has not claimed expertise in or really been involved in up till now. It's really kind of trying to move into that area, and my concern, and I think overall the concern, is that this is an area where they just don't have that kind of expertise. Technical experts. We should certainly be engaging with them in setting cybercrime policy. We should be dealing with that. But not every organization can be all things to all people. And the Budapest Convention was brought together a number of countries, and since then we've done outreach to many, many more countries around the world to kind of develop the legal standards and the but that's really different from that's really different from the technical standards. And as Ambassador Sepulveda has said, and certainly the State Department has talked about, you know, the process for setting technical standards on the internet is a much more multi-stakeholder approach. We need input from civil society groups and others in that role, and that's something that the ITU is really, that's not been their overall model. And so that's, you know, I think that'll be an issue for greater discussion next week.
So, you know, you mentioned in your explanation of sort of the varying roles of CSIPs that one of the hats CSIPs plays is in advising on the collection and use of electronic evidence. It's been a very busy time in the courts over the last year or two when it comes to electronic evidence, with the Jones case regarding trackers and the Riley case involving searches of cell phones incident to arrest. And there's been, as you know, continued and confusing litigation over the standards that govern the acquisition of cell site location information. Where do you think the courts and Congress, to the extent Congress is involved, headed on the cell site location information issue in particular?
Well, it's on Congress. We're having an election tomorrow, so it's difficult.
Premature to say.
Yeah. You know, it's hard for me to guess exactly how any of the current the proposals are going to shape up in a new Congress. We'll have to see that. As far as the practical effect of, you know, Riley and Jones, we're definitely seeing the Supreme Court and courts take a very, very close look at how people use technology, how law enforcement can use that technology. Jones is, I think, you know, the sort of meatier academic case, because it's almost a casebook of three different approaches to the same issue, and they all came to the same result, but they came from different approaches. And so you're seeing a lot of academic work, I think, that's based upon Jones and trying to tease out how the Jones principles, which of the coalitions and which of the sort of ideas will win out in trying to determine how, you know, old principles of trespass and common law principles generally are going to apply to this new technology. Riley, courts are just beginning to take that up, but it's, you know, I think fairly clear from Justice Roberts dealt with the overall issue that they're willing to say, at least in some cases, you know, this was the rule for the physical world. This is going to be the rule for electronic devices. Law enforcement's going to have to adapt to that. We're going to have to be skilled at explaining, you know, why things may be similar to the physical world, why the principles of a given doctrine should hold true for electronic evidence. And I think being able to explain that technology accurately and clearly is a big part of, to judges, is going to be a big part of what we do, and that's something that CSIPs has been tackling for nearly 20 years now.
So are you guys going to file amicus in the hotel registry case that the court has taken, which, you know, is going to, almost inevitably going to touch on a bunch of third party questions?
The department hasn't taken a position on that yet.
Okay. Your institutional interests are all wrapped up in that. It would be crazy to say, well, we don't have laws like that, so we're not going to file.
Yeah, I totally understand that those decisions are made by the Office of Solicitor General, and so we are, we're kind of waiting for the decision there, and, you know, we find out almost at the same time everyone else does, so.
So let me jump in and ask a question that you knew I was going to ask, where I think CSIPs has actually protected more computer crime than it stopped, and that's in the area that sometimes goes under the name of hackback. And I'll give you one clear example where the department's guidance, I think, is contributing to cybercrime. It is common for people who are stealing data to run little programs inside your the victim's system to have those programs, when they're ready, exfiltrate the data in a big hurry, late at night, logging onto a third party's, you know, third country server, dropping off all the stolen data there, and then the actual thieves check in with those servers maybe every few hours, maybe once a day, and scoop up everything that's been deposited by the 100 or 200 companies that are in touch with that command and control server. If you find that has happened to you, and that's usually when people do discover it, you can reverse engineer the software often and figure out what the login information is to that command and control server. And since the data isn't picked up immediately, you actually, if you're very fast, you can log in and you can take the stuff back and defeat the attack. But many people read your guidance, which says essentially if you leave the confines of your computer and you go onto somebody else's computer and you do anything on it, you could be committing a felony. And it's, I think, some idiot at your section actually said it's not just illegal, it's immoral. And yet, there's no way law enforcement is going to stop that. That is only going to get stopped by the defensive people working in the company who get the alerts and who can quickly figure out where their data has gone, and they've got 3 hours to get it back. How can you give out guidance that tells people that they shouldn't be doing stuff like that?
Well, there's a good questions there. I mean, there's a first of all, in your hypothetical, we don't know where who owns that computer, what other damage.
I stipulate it's MIT.
Okay, so you now have individuals going into MIT's computer without authorization from MIT. That's obviously going to create. MIT has property interest in that computer system, and there's a lot to how you go about things. The OJ thought, the Heisman Trophy has my name on it, so, I'm going to take it back, but, taking it back at gunpoint wasn't the right call for him. You have some ability to go to law enforcement. You can talk to law enforcement. We have a 24/7 capability. FBI does as well. And working with us can be productive. That said, we do also have, in the common law, necessity and justification defenses, and those things are, have been applied in many contexts. And I don't see why they couldn't apply necessarily here. But I mean, if you're saying, why doesn't the statute have it's totally okay to go into, to break into MIT server and take back and delete your data. Well, that's something that I think is looked at by prosecutors, and judges on a individual case by case basis, and creating a, rule that says, yeah, well, breaking into computers is okay as long as you're chasing after your own data, and writing that into the statute is a very hard thing to do. It'll create, I think, more problems than it solves.
I agree with you, but I don't think your guidance says anything about necessity or justification, or even about the gray area of some of this. And as I said, somebody recently said, this isn't just illegal, it's immoral.
It was not me, but I would take some umbrage at the idiot in my section comment.
I actually think it was an AUSA who said it wasn't even someone at CSIS. But, in Stuart's hypothetical, obviously becomes much more complicated if it's not MIT, but it's the Russian Institute of Technology, because there are a lot of cross-border issues there too. One of the ways Stuart and I know you think I've gone to the dark side on this issue since I left the government, but I'm not quite on Stuart's side of the ledger yet. But one of the ways in which Stuart and I think differ on this is, I think his beef is not with the section interpreting the statute, but with people who wrote it. That the statute says what it says. I think that no lawyer in his right mind would advise a client, given what the law says, not what CSIP says the law says, but what the law itself says, to engage in activity that would take them sort of outside the confines of their own network, with the law written the way it's written. Because, you know, you can tell someone that the odds are that you won't be indicted, you won't be criminally prosecuted, but the statute certainly makes that a very realistic possibility, and you can only be wrong once in that situation before people just stop listening to you. But what do you think, given that the law is what it is? You know, Michael talked earlier about the Axiom matter, where a bunch of private sector companies engaged in a type of self-help, and you and I worked on the CoreFlow botnet matter together, and been a bunch of other botnet takedowns that Microsoft and others have engaged in. But what do you think is, given the confines of the laws that exist today, what's the role of the private sector in going after and disrupting cyber criminals beyond just reporting things to law enforcement and sharing information?
Right. Well, I think that's a great question. And, you know, from what I've seen of the Axiom, effort, you had, groups coming together, identifying a common threat that went through a number of different industries. They developed intelligence and made decisions based upon what they were seeing on their own networks about what that group was focusing on and how the malware was acting. And they provided signatures primarily to their customers, but also more generally through Microsoft to help people, you know, clean their systems. That seems like good cybersecurity to me. It's information sharing. It's it's people taking initiative for their own systems or for systems that they've been contracted to protect. Companies don't have to be completely passive in order to protect themselves, and that's never what we've suggested. This, I think, is a good example of the private sector taking action on their own networks and, you know, eliminating a threat. Law enforcement is not going to be able to do every one of these, be involved in every single takedown, and I think that the private sector has a big role to play in this area. They own the infrastructure. They have the technical expertise to understand their systems much better than we will. On the other hand, they should, I think, be careful to act and make sure that they have the necessary authorizations and permissions in place, among themselves, so that everybody knows what the scope of the action is going to be before it's taken, at least within the group that they're talking about. And if they take actions that affect somebody else's network adversely, I think that they do have legal risk. It may not be criminal legal risk, but it could be civil legal risk, and it could come not just from, you know, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the federal statutes, but a number of, you know, every time I open the paper, there's a new civil theory for somebody taking some sort of action online and somebody's getting sued over it.
Quick question: if the Treasury Department had said, "Well, we have a problem too. We're in exactly the same position as some of these other folks. We'd like to join this Axiom effort." Would that have actually meant that everybody else was committing a violation of federal law by sharing information with the government without a subpoena under ECPA?
It depends on the level of the information. The department in the last year has issued a white paper. It's available up on cybercrime.gov that talks about sharing kind of aggregate threat information. Not every single piece of information that may relate to a customer subscriber that may have in the aggregate relate to the operation of the internet, it can be, I think, needs to be prohibited from law enforcement. We need to be cautious of privacy concerns and, you know, get government getting information without the proper judicial authority when it's specific and it's directed at a customer. I think that's That's something that, you know, certainly we think about a lot. But, you know, if you're talking about sort of aggregate thread information or, you know, signatures that are abstracted from that customer, subscriber data, that information, I think, you know, can be shared in many instances. And certainly the administration is looking to, expand the ways in which we can have, you know, bidirectional, data flow, between the government and the private sector on these threats, and to do it in a way that, you know, allows people to take action, but does not necessarily adversely affect privacy.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that there are sort of increasingly creative theories that private plaintiffs come up with to bring lawsuits whenever anything happens online. And as you know, it was true even before Target, but certainly even more true after. Literally, as soon as a breach report is filed, almost simultaneously with the filing of the breach report, there's litigation that follows. And when we advise clients all the time about breach risk, we also talk about litigation risk. In the wake of Target and other high-profile breaches, have you found that companies are less willing to cooperate with law enforcement because they're worried that the information they provide to law enforcement will come back to haunt them in litigation? Or are you finding that the litigation risk that is always out there for companies that are the victims of breaches is not interfering with the extent to which they're cooperating with law enforcement?
I think it has depended. You know, certainly Target, you know, the Target intrusion and sort of the follow-up actions by Target's own board have really brought the C-suite's attention to the issue of data breaches in a way that I think it was there before, but it's heightened when, you know, it sort of becomes a job security issue for the CEO. And so I think, you know, we see different companies reacting in different ways, but, you know, they are writing incident playbooks and defining the various roles that people should play in, you know, in the event of a detection of a data breach. You know, it has been in some ways good for us. We now have a more consistent, you know, that we have companies hiring forensics firms, hiring law firms. And while, you know, different firms will have different approaches to how much information they want to share with law enforcement at the beginning, at least we have a consistent interface, and there's a way to talk about what information we need, how we can get it without disrupting the operations of the organization as possible, how to do it in a way that doesn't continually re-victimize the victim. And that has been, I think, a positive development in this area. You do have companies, and there was a Wall Street Journal story a couple months ago that talked about sort of, you know, the ostrich approach of just trying to hide it. I don't think that is necessarily good. You know, it's certainly not good for law enforcement writ large, because we're trying to put together, you know, this intrusion here maybe linked to another intrusion somewhere else. I also don't think it's necessarily the best approach for companies that have responsibilities to their shareholders, and may, you know, and may later find out that what they thought was a, you know, manageable data breach was actually a lot bigger, or targeted intellectual property that was worth a lot more than, say, name and address, you know, employee name and address information that they thought the original intrusion was. But you also have, you know, data breach notification laws, and you have an increased interest by regulators, SEC, the financial regulators, and so forth, that are focused on if this kind of thing happens, this needs to be reported, and companies are having to deal with that, and law enforcement is going to be a piece of that, and we want to be as useful and helpful as we can to victims in that sort of context.
Okay. Thank you, John, for participating in the podcast today, and thank you to Stuart and Michael as well. Before we sign off, we'd like to give everybody the opportunity to plug any upcoming speaking engagements you have. Is there anything coming up on your calendar, Stuart, that you'd like to promote?
I will spend Thursday in Pittsburgh. I fly back Wednesday from Dublin, debating privacy and NSA at the Zittrain Forum, named not after Jonathan but after his parents. And that's on Thursday in Pittsburgh.
Nothing for me too this week. As a reminder, as Stuart mentioned earlier in the program, the Cyber Law Podcast is now open to feedback from our listeners. We ask you to send your questions or suggestions for interview candidates or suggestions for topics to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. And if you'd like to leave a message by phone, you can also contact us at 1-202-862-5785. This has been episode 41 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Next week, we'll have guest commentator Troels Ørting of the European Cybercrime Center, also known as EC3. And we hope you'll join us as we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. Thanks for joining us.